This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We will visit with Reverend Gene Mills, president of the Louisiana Family Forum, and the Reverend Chris Andrews, who for more than 20 years was the pastor at First United Methodist Church in Baton Rouge. They'll talk about the significance of the 45th anniversary today of the Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion in America, Roe v. Wade. Also on the show, we're slated to hear from singer Luther Kent, who will remember his dear friend John Fred, who 50 years ago today was at the top of the charts with Judy in Disguise. And Franz Settlemyer, his book is Welcome to Putingrad. He will talk about going to war in the courts with Vladimir Putin and winning. He's believed to be the only man to take on Putin in Russia and come out on top. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. Outside the area, that's a toll-free number. And if you're in Baton Rouge, you can save a few numbers and call 297-5633. The email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Amid the federal government shutdown, today is the 45th anniversary of perhaps the most significant Supreme Court decision in modern time. The Roe v. Wade decision came on January 22, 1973, 45 years ago. And with us to talk about the significance of this, and certainly there has been relevance in Louisiana for many, many years. Remember the showdown over the abortion issue in 1990 at the state capitol with Buddy Romer, then governor, vetoing two bills. It continues to be a source of division and, of course, something that people have passionate feelings about. And we look forward to hearing from you if you're so inclined. But please remember that our guests are gentlemen, and we would prefer that our audience acts with civility as well. 877-217-5757. Reverend Chris Andrews is with us, the former pastor of First United Methodist Church, now with Jubilee Pioneers and also Rebuilding Together Baton Rouge, and the Reverend Gene Mills, the founder of the Louisiana Family Forum, and certainly a pro-life stalwart. Gene Mills, Reverend Mills, let's begin with you. This is 45 years, this decision. Do you think we're on the brink of overturning Roe v. Wade?
Well, first of all, good morning, Jim. Good morning, Chris. It's good to be with you on this rainy Monday morning in Louisiana. Some have said that we are one step closer, obviously, with the appointment of Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. We certainly have confirmed that we have a 5-4 court in 75% of the cases, with Kennedy being the swing vote in about 75% of those cases. And there's early indication that as early as June or July, there may be another vacancy on the court. So there's a very real possibility we may have another challenge from a state on the personhood. And I think that's really the underlying thesis that in law and throughout these 45 years has been debated, is what constitutes personhood and when does it begin? And that has been the source of the debate all these years.
Reverend Andrews, how do you see it?
Well, good morning to you, Jim and Gene. Good to hear your voice again, both of you. You know, life is not a neat playing field, and there are a lot of things that happen in life that I wish would happen in a different way. But as far as Roe v. Wade goes, I think that it is a step that allows a woman and her counselors, her doctors, to act in a way that every person ought to have the right to act, that is to take care of their own body and their own needs. I think, Gene, you're right. I think the tide is turning, and it may well be that if we think in terms of sides here, that your side is about to see a different landscape out there. I think that would be unfortunate. I stand for women having the right to determine their own destiny as far as their health and well-being.
877-217-5757 or talk@talklouisiana.org. Some questions already in from listeners. This one from Delia to you, Reverend Mills, saying, given the Bible's scores of specific prescriptions and prohibited actions, why does your guest explain the absence of a specific prescription on abortion?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
Well, does the Bible address abortion at all?
Yes, it does. It talks about under which terms life may be taken, and they're very narrow, extremely limited, and under a great judicial process, both under Judaic civil law, which applied then, but also the basis and the thesis of Scripture as it pertains to the distinct value of all human life. And that is the argument that we've brought forward, is that, look, when the sperm and the egg unite, an immortal cell, an immortal soul that will live forever is created. And it's not a division process, it's a multiplication process, which, Jim, continues in your body, continues in mine as well with the multiplications of cells. It is a distinctly supernatural event that takes place that can be explained naturally, but it cannot be terminated naturally without consequences. And that has been the challenge, is under what terms are we allowed to do that? And they're very limited.
Are you an advocate of capital punishment?
I am. And yet I'm still very involved in criminal justice reform. And I got to tell you, it's an insanely complicated component. And delayed justice, it makes it even more difficult. But we are working through the entire criminal justice system, the felony class system. There'll be additional work that's done, both with the redeeming value of every life, as well as the civic consequence of taking a human life. And I believe those are two are reconcilable.
Reverend Andrews, back to the original question, does the Bible address abortion?
I do not think that it does. I think that the Bible, I agree with Gene, I think what you're saying, Gene, is that life is sacred, and I certainly affirm that statement and believe that with all of my heart. And that's why I say that abortion is one of those unfortunate but necessary choices that have to be opted for in certain circumstances. To revere the sacredness of life is to protect the lives that are here. And it's always been something of a conundrum to me how people of your perspective, Gene, can support capital punishment and yet be so adamant about abortion and, you know, never allowing that to happen. And to me, that's just illogical. It doesn't make good sense.
I, for one, am
totally opposed to capital punishment. So I guess I'm on the other side of your side there.
Well, the distinction for me is entirely theological, and it represents the fact that I view Scripture as the inerrant Word of God. So it informs both the questions and the terms upon which they may be executed and the manner in which it may be executed. So in Genesis, when God says that if one man sheds another man's blood, by another shall his blood be shed, it was prescriptive about a prohibition against taking of human life and the terms at which that would be suspended to discipline one who has. And my sense is the Scripture informs that question. Now, civil law gives us a much grayer area and much greater area to discuss. Well, what then are consent? What constitutes consent? When can that be impacted? In Oregon right now, we have, for instance, physician-assisted suicide. And in Louisiana, because of the Roe v. Wade decision, a plethora of pro-life laws are in suspense. I don't know if you know this, Jim, but if Roe v. Wade were overturned today, abortion would be banned in Louisiana.
Well, yeah, it certainly would. And now, Reverend Andrews is pastor of a large flock. I would imagine there have been times in your career as a man of the cloth that parishioners have come to you with an issue about whether to terminate a pregnancy. How did you handle that?
Well, each one is a different issue. Every circumstance has its own unique parameters, and so we looked at each one individually. Frankly, I didn't have a whole lot of that, but I did have some. And the one that stands out in my mind that allows me to say abortion in some circumstances is the best option was a young woman, a young girl, 13 years old, impregnated by a neighbor who was doing things with her after school when her parents were not at home. And this child now is carrying a baby. I helped that family go to Texas and receive medical treatment so that that pregnancy could be terminated. Today, that young woman is in her mid-40s. She's a mother. She's a wife. She's a leader in her community. Those are the kinds of realities that I think we have to consider when we think about this very emotional issue of abortion. And one size just doesn't fit all. We need to look at this in a very measured way. We need to be very serious about it. We need to be prayerful. We need to regard the sacredness of life, but that includes the sacredness of the life of the person who has to carry a life that may have been begun in most tragic and unfortunate ways.
And Jim, I would concur with that. I agree with Chris on that. Problem is that that's not the end of all the stories. As a director of a crisis counseling center that I oversaw for 10 years, starting the first crisis pregnancy center at a university campus at LSU, and the second only in the nation at the time at Southern University, I had counselors who had had earlier life abortions who so regretted that decision that ultimately they ended up taking their lives because they couldn't deal with the regret and the consternation that they felt in their own soul and the inability to forgive themselves. And it's not a safe, legal, and rare procedure like we've been told it ought to be. 1 in 10 women before age 20 in America will have had an abortion. 1 in 4 by 30. 3 in 10 by 45. And one thing that they all have in common is 75% live at or below the poverty level. This is an economic impact upon a person who is in a nefarious situation that oftentimes needs a little encouragement and a lifeline, and in many cases will make a better decision.
That's true, Gene. And when you mention economics, I think that's a very, very important factor, which is one of the reasons that it's, again, something of an irony that there are people on the right who want to defund Planned Parenthood.
877-217-5757. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 45 years ago today, the U.S. Supreme Court on a 7-2 decision made abortion legal in America. And Chris Andrews and Gene Mills are with us, both reverends. And Gene Mills is correct that if the Supreme Court, now with a solid conservative majority with Neil Gorsuch on the court, votes to overturn Roe v. Wade, then abortion will be outlawed in Louisiana. And we're going to go to the phone lines in just a moment. And John in New Roads has a good point, saying we've got three old white guys talking about abortion. And in the past on this show, we've had Marjorie Essman of the ACLU and Sally Campbell, who, of course, is a friend and colleague of Gene Mills, opposite sides. We've had women on this issue, but today we do have three white guys who are past 50 years old on this show talking about abortion. And if you'd like to call and you're a woman, even better. So there we are. We start with Lindsay in Mississippi. Lindsay, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, sir. I would like to speak for the unborn child. I am now 79 years old in just 6 weeks. My mother made two sincere attempts to abort me by using a coat hanger, poking at my head, and I refused to die. I was so hard-headed before I was born that I would not die. And when she would beat me often until she broke my skin, she would tell me about how hard-headed I was.
All right. Do you have a question, Lindsay? Do you have a question for, I suppose, Reverend Andrews, most likely? What is your question?
My question is, we should consider the life of the child. If you're going to insist that the child be born, please find it a loving family where it will be welcomed.
Indeed, Lindsay, and kudos to you for being the tough soul that you obviously are and for surviving what sounds like some pretty horrendous life experiences. And that's part of the issue, I think, is that unwanted children suffer horribly. And I think that in some instances it is better, as much as it pains me to say this, to have never been born than to be born into a hellacious atmosphere where you're going to be abused and mistreated and where a cycle starts that continues to repeat itself over and over again. So we have children having children. You know, this is complicated, heart-wrenching stuff. I'm simply saying that abortion is one of the options that we have to leave on the table if we're going to really be faithful in our society at dealing with human heartache and human fallacy.
Reverend Mills, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, thank God Lindsay's still here and still has a passionate voice at 79. I think she is a walking testimony and a miracle, not only to the distinct value of each life, but to the value of the lives of the unborn and the importance of the family. You know, there was once upon a time a common thesis that the basic building block of society was the married two-parent family. It's where we made children, we made socialization skills possible, we made education possible, we taught them our values, and then we imparted to them a necessary skill for the next step. And when we began to deconstruct that, and there are a million little ways in which we do, and some rather large ones, like no-fault divorce, where men and women can walk away from a family or a child and their obligation to that child. And it extremely complicates things, but I would caution you that the nearly 600,000 little boys and girls that have been aborted in Louisiana since Roe v. Wade and the nearly 59 million in America is not the remedy to bring a respect for life value back. What will bring that back is appreciating and representing and voicing a dignity of all human lives. And that precludes our ability to terminate a life.
All right. Now, Mary in Donaldsonville echoes John in New Roads, saying that men basically don't have the standing to talk about this issue. We'll never be faced with a dilemma on whether to have an abortion. So does that negate your authority on this issue, Reverend Mills and Reverend Andrews, for that matter?
I've had 8 children. We've lost 3 to miscarriage, so I would beg to differ. I've been through crisis pregnancies quite a few times. I just carry the other side of the equation and the responsibility to raise those children, like Chris and I agree, should be raised with the loving care of both a mom and a dad.
Your children have been fortunate, Gene, so have mine, but we both know that there are a lot of children who are not so, and I really hesitate to speak about this because I think the points made by the individual in New Roads and the lady in Donaldsonville is true. We are men, and we do not know what it means to have in our own being another life that, you know, we're going to have to carry to term, that sometimes will bring and has started under the most unfortunate and tragic of circumstances. I'm thinking of rape. I'm thinking of incest. I'm thinking of a child mm-hmm. who becomes impregnated. These are tough things, which is why I think we have to have, as a part of this, abortion. The other thing, Gene, is, you know, I get your thoughts on this. What about sex education? What about the work that goes into preventing unwanted pregnancies? That's something I think we need to double down on in our society. And it's an unfortunate circumstance right now that seems the political winds are such that we want to take funding away from the very agencies mm-hmm. that would provide that kind of service.
Yeah, Chris, you seem to agree that the government ought to be involved in certain things, whether it's taxpayer funding of abortion, the termination of human lives, as controversial as it is, as well as sex education. I believe that we do have a wonderful sex education law. It's voluntary, so a parent can opt out or a child can opt out, and abstinence must be its source. We must remember that what is one child's medicinal remedy, a doctor's conversation, a pill, or a medical procedure, could destroy many other children.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Reverend Mills and Reverend Andrews. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Reverend Mills, you talk about the sanctity of life, but are you aware that Gorsuch made the top of that 20-candidate list of the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation because he's the ultimate judge for corporate America?
All right. Well, that's a different topic, but Neil Gorsuch, according to many on the conservative side of the political spectrum, Reverend Mills, the most likable thing about him from that perspective is that most conservatives believe he will vote to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Well, he does much more than that. We're likely to get a decision on religious liberty that he heard and argued just a few days ago. I walked before the chambers of the U.S. Supreme Court just 3 days ago with a gentleman who argued that case. And Neil Gorsuch is a fine gentleman. He is likely to stand for the dignity of all human life. And I'm sure there will be some decisions that we may disagree upon, but I think he will use jurisprudence and the strict construction of the Constitution rather.
All right. Now, Reverend Andrews, as far as Neil Gorsuch, he was voted in by a Republican-dominated Senate. Our two U.S. senators, Bill Cassidy and John Kennedy, both voted for his confirmation. It appears that he may very well be the fifth vote if a decision or if a case comes before the court involving abortion.
I think that's a distinct possibility. I think he's indicated his point of view and his political leanings, and I think you're right. It may well happen.
877-217-5757, and because of the sensitivity of this subject and the interest in it, Luther Kent, the fabulous musician from this area who's a great friend of John Fred, has agreed to wait until tomorrow to discuss the legacy of John Fred Gourier, who 50 years ago was at the top of the charts with Judy in Disguise. For 2 weeks, he supplanted the Beatles and Hello, Goodbye, and the man from Baton Rouge, who died at the age of 63 in 2005, was number one on the Billboard chart. A hard task, to put it in perspective, Creedence Clearwater Revival, great band from the 60s and 70s, never had a number one. But John Fred did, and he wrote the song as well. And we'll talk with Luther Kent tomorrow about the legacy of John Fred Gourier. Chris Andrews, pastor of Jubilee Pioneers and former pastor of the First United Methodist Church for 22 years downtown, also involved in this community of Baton Rouge with Rebuilding Together Baton Rouge. He's with us, along with Reverend Gene Mills, who's president of the Louisiana Family Forum. Your number again, 877-217-5757. One line is open, and we'll return with Reverend Mills and Reverend Andrews after this pause for the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. It was 45 years ago today that Lyndon Baines Johnson, the 36th American president, died at the age of 64. And because of that and other things that were happening on that day, Roe v. Wade, the decision that legalized abortion in America, did not make the front pages of many major American newspapers. But it is the story of that day that has been a dominant story for 45 years. And with us talking about the significance of this and where we are now is Chris Andrews, pastor of Jubilee Pioneers, and also joining us is the Reverend Gene Mills, founder of the Louisiana Family Forum. And it is true that we have men discussing this, but unfortunately, men are the ones who tend to make these decisions. It would be nice if there were more women. There have only been 51 women in the history of the United States Senate. And of the Supreme Court justices, three of the nine are women, and they would all vote based on prior votes to keep Roe v. Wade. What do you think? Let's start with Melanie on 100 Oaks. Melanie, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Reverend Mills and Reverend Andrews.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I am saddened that a decision that should belong to a woman who may have been raped or otherwise has significant health risks from pregnancy is in the hands of politicians, and that the discussion is often put in the hands of men. But because it's been politicized, I'd like to hear from our speakers their thoughts on some of the other factors that usually reduce rates of abortion. We know that as education level, economic success, access to health care, and security for women rises, abortion rates fall. And yet we're seeing conservative politicians in Louisiana gutting many of the programs that would benefit women, and women make much less money in the state. So I'd like to hear our guest speakers discuss why it seems to be okay to reduce access to resources for women while also taking decisions out of their hands about their bodies.
Reverend Mills, let's begin with you.
Well, Louisiana hasn't taken that decision out of anybody's hand. It's still legal in the state of Louisiana, but marriage is the best remedy to the likelihood of abortion. I think the likelihood that an intact functional relationship that unites intimacy inside of a bond of marriage that's lifelong, preferably, is the number one precursor or predictor of whether or not a young person will find themselves in a situation, or a young woman in a crisis situation, where she feels as though that's the only option she has. I think we ought to be able to offer better options.
Reverend Andrews?
I think Melanie raises some very significant issues, and I think that one of the things that we have done as a society is we've turned our back on some of the most vulnerable and hard-pressed people, the poor, the young, the very needy. We need sex education, and that needs to happen in our society. And yet, you know, my conservative friends oppose that at almost every turn, saying it needs to be something done in the home. Well, that would be wonderful if homes were the places where that could happen, but the reality is it's not happening. We need to fund organizations like Planned Parenthood, which provides free health care for women who otherwise are not going to get that health care. And I don't know why we continue to put up these roadblocks and Bill Gates around those very services that will help to achieve what I think Gene and I both want, which is good life for our citizens and a reverence for life rather than a trivialization of life through its destruction wantonly.
Q in on Old Hammond. Hi, Q. You're on the air with Reverend Mills and Reverend Andrews.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I did want to make a statement that I'm very happy that someone did address the subpar sex education that we have here in Louisiana. Abstinence-only sex education is okay for some people, but we need proper sex education. I know adults who have no idea that babies or unborn babies are not aborted in the ninth month. And that doesn't happen. It's called birth. But I also wanted to ask, can two people have rights over one body? And I also want to make the statement that I did research and found out that women die more in childbirth than they do in abortion.
All right. Thank you, Q. Reverend Andrews.
Well, Q, the sex education matter that you lift up, I think, is paramount. I think we need to do that as a society. I think we've been given this sacred gift to be co-creators with the great creator of life, and we need to do that well and wisely and with great care, and education is the key.
Reverend Mills?
Yeah, I would say not as many women have died during pregnancy as children have died during an abortion. And to Q's concern about sex education, there's no appropriate way to speak inappropriate things to a child. And the problem with Planned Parenthood's view of sex education is pregnancy is treated as a disease, which is treatable by a number of outcomes, including abortion. And I have a real problem with taxpayer funding of that type of philosophy being.
All right, I see you frowning, Reverend Andrews.
Well, I don't think that's accurate. I don't think Planned Parenthood does that at all, treats pregnancy as a disease. It looks at the reality that people are living with every day and simply seeks to help them cope with that reality. Planned Parenthood does not do abortions in Louisiana. It provides birth control services and educational services and health care for women mm-hmm. who otherwise are not going to receive that.
Nathan writes, rather than exhausting energy and overturning a law, would the single best course of action be to support any of the women who need some help? What about offering support to women and their children that will be born if abortion is outlawed in this country, Reverend Mills?
Well, I think that's being done, and right now we're trying to expand that. But we're trying to do it with services that actually produce a product and not just a dependent. And the way to do that is to teach people energy and thrift, help them to obtain educational credentials and employment if, when necessary.
All right. Megan, and kind of a similar question, says, does Reverend Mills believe that if a woman is forced to have a child that she should be granted access to health care, housing, food, et cetera, to support that child, or should she be left alone with unlimited resources to raise the child?
Well, right now she is entitled to those types of benefits. They are not unlimited. They're very limited. And it seems to me that my remedy for a married two-parent family with a child under the care of an at-home mother would extend certain benefits to that one, to that mm-hmm. child that only has one mm-hmm. parent. And that mother should be able to stay at home at least for a season in that child's life as well.
Reverend Andrews?
Well, certainly there's no one who can give a child better care than the mother. And anything we can do to support that bond and to strengthen it, I would be in favor of it. I just come back, though, to my good friend Gene's perspective and say that the reason that he and I are on opposite ends of some issues is that we don't see the social landscape the same way. I wish we had two-parent families. I wish we had that kind of world, but we don't have that kind of world. We have a world in which there are there's just a lot of brokenness, and in that broken world, the work that we do to help people and to regard life in a sacred and reverent way is never going to be neat. It's never going to be a one-size-fits-all. And we just, you know, we trudge mm-hmm. forward into the thicket and do the best we can. And sometimes what offerings we can put forth are not pretty ones, they are necessary.
AJ asks if your position on this issue, Reverend Mills, would be the same if you were a non-believer as opposed to being the fervent evangelical person that you are.
Well, I don't know that I would even be weighing in on this. I'd be pursuing what a non-believer pursues, and it's not to either communicate a moral value or an ideal or to communicate a truth that we are obligated by Scripture to communicate to society. So likely no.
All right. Is that what this comes down to, Reverend Andrews? If somebody like Reverend Mills, and I'm sure many of our listeners, they have fervent religious beliefs that supersede anything else.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm a religious person too, so I honor that. I simply come at it from a whole different orientation and a different process. So, you know, I've known people who are so-called non-believers who, in my opinion, ethically and morally are light years ahead of believers.
David in Atlanta. Please be brief, David. We're short on time, but I want to get you in with Reverend Mills and Reverend Andrews. Hi, David.
The United States is the only advanced nation in the world that doesn't have legally mandated paid maternity leave. I'd like to know, would Reverend Mills support that? Also, would you support legally married gay and lesbian couples adopting?
All right. Paid maternity leave and gay people adopting children. What are your thoughts about those two issues, Reverend Mills?
I'm very concerned about empowering government and its police power to continue to do much of what Chris believes the government can accomplish. I've seen very limited successes within the government arena. I believe in the private arena there's a great deal of ingenuity. As far as LGBT marriage and adoption rates, those are legal as well in the state of Louisiana. I am certainly not of the opinion that every child needs or any child needs two of one type of parent. I think they need a mother and a father.
Reverend Andrews?
I would have no problem with same-sex couples adopting a child and raising that child as their own. My wife and I have some lovely neighbors who, in fact, are same-sex, and they have a beautiful daughter, and we enjoy them very much, and we have many friends like that.
Well, we thank both of you for joining us for a thoughtful discussion on a difficult issue, and it is an issue that the three of us will never have to face. We'll never have to decide whether to have an abortion ourselves, but nonetheless, the decision makers in this country remain predominantly men, and we have two men here passionate about their religious beliefs, but also passionate about the world at large. Thank you, Reverend Mills, and thank you, Reverend Andrews.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you,
God
Gene.
You. Thank you, guys.
And we'll be back after this time out with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Locally, 297-5633 in Baton Rouge. And the email is talk@talklouisiana.org. With us is Franz Settlemyer. He's the author of Welcome to Putingrad, the memoir of his time in Russia and his precedent-shattering case against President Vladimir Putin and the Russian Federation. And it is a remarkable story. And good morning to you, Franz.
Good morning, Jim. How are you today?
Doing well. You went to the Soviet Union when you were 26 years old. You didn't know anybody there, and it was a totalitarian police state. What drove you, Franz, to take such a blind jump?
Actually, the place was not as totalitarian at the time as one would think because of Mr. Gorbachev, who brought about perestroika, which means change, who brought about glasnost, which sort of was a very mild form of democratization of society. And so all signals perceived in the West were somewhat pointing in the right direction. And I went over there to look at the setup of their local police force in then what was Leningrad and what is now St. Petersburg, which is very close to the Finnish border. And I went there, of course, rather nervous what I would find. And actually, I had a wonderful week, and I met very interesting people. And I could also see that the country is in shambles. And when you just take the police department as an example, they had no vehicles, they had not right. enough uniforms, they had no training whatsoever, and they were basically railroaded by organized crime.
Well, this was horrible. 1989, so we're talking almost three decades ago, but you met a young man who was about 35 years old, young to be at a high place in government, named Vladimir Putin. How was that experience, and what was he up to in 1989?
In 1989, he was still active in Dresden. He only came back to St. Petersburg in 1990, and I first met him in 1992, and he was responsible for foreign investment in the city of Leningrad at the time. Mind you, the Soviet Union just had disintegrated. Now you were sitting in Russia, surrounded by 14 other republics that used to be the same country. And when I went in there and talked to him, I had a very particular problem I needed solved, and he was less than helpful during that meeting. He was actually cold as a fish, and it took me quite a while to cultivate him.
Well, ultimately, you ended up having some business dealings that went south in Russia. And to date, the gentleman we're speaking with, Franz Settlemyer, the author of Welcome to Putingrad, is the only claimant who has collected on a claim from a sovereign debtor being Russia in the case Settlemyer versus the Russian Federation. What happened in that case?
Well, Vladimir Putin and I were working since 92 until 1996. 1996, President Boris Yeltsin decided he liked our real estate, so he nationalized our company and our company real estate, which essentially put me out of business. It also ended my relationship with Vladimir Putin right then and there because he was trying to help, but he couldn't, and he basically had to distance himself. He explained that to me, too. He said, I still have a career to make, and as we can see, he was right. And what happened is with the nationalization, I found a way to bring arbitration, in other words, a lawsuit against the Russian Federation to get compensated for my loss. I won, and the Russians never paid, and so I had to go and take them and had to enforce against them. And I did so successfully.
Now, you write that Putin should be nervous these days. He seems to be very comfortable in his position, but why should he be nervous?
Well, because, you know, Putin has relied on people around him. He has made a deal. Russia is a huge country, as you know, and he's not in control of all of Russia. What he has done is basically said, whoever is in local politics and in local power, you can take what you want as long as you don't interfere with me as president, as long as you don't act against Kremlin policies, as long as you don't disturb the business dealings of my oligarch friends. And that is really what has kept him in control. And now people start realizing, especially with all the sanctions going on over Crimea, eastern Ukraine, and so forth, that their standard of living is on a very steep decline. The ruble is under inflation like never before. And people suffer from day to day from daily corruption. I mean, it's penetrated society so much that it's a daily struggle for the people. There is no rule of law. There is only rule of law available for those who can afford it. In other words, pay for it.
Well, and welcome to Putingrad. You say you spent hours with him drinking beer, eating German food. Apparently he likes that fare. And he is thought by some, President Bush being one, to be, he said he looked in his eyes and saw his soul, but the vice president at that time, Dick Cheney, says he looked in his eyes and saw a cold-blooded killer. Who is Vladimir Who is Vladimir Putin?
I think that's very similar to what Senator McCain said at the time. And I think it goes to show that people don't really understand who Vladimir Putin is and what his professional training is. As you remember, he was doing a rather limited career, I might say, in the KGB, and his function, and his only function, was to recruit informants and recruit people to provide information to the KGB. So he was a personnel guy, if you want, and he's trained. When he sees an asset that he wants to recruit, he's projecting himself to the other person like a mirror. The other person will see all types of good things sitting across from him. And Mr. Putin is very good in dealing with people one-on-one, and when he concentrates on someone like George W. Bush, he's doing a fantastic job being nice to the man. When he meets someone like Senator McCain, which doesn't take as seriously, he's treating him quite differently. So he can change his colors very, very rapidly.
Franz Putin and Russia have been charged with trying to influence the 2016 election in the United States. What do you make of these charges?
Oh, I think they're absolutely true and they're well-founded. But don't forget, it doesn't take a Vladimir Putin to give the order to do something like this. This is in their DNA. The KGB and now what is the success organization FSB has a standard operating procedure, and that is to upset Western democracies, to sow distrust between NATO partners, to make sure that our relationship between Europe and the United States, the transatlantic relations, suffer, that they create havoc to a certain extent wherever they can. And what they have done in the United States, they have done in dozens of other countries.
What do you make of the relationship between President Putin and President Trump?
Well, between Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump, people might be surprised to hear that I think there's more similarities, that they share more similarities between them than what sets them apart. They're both guys who decide in an instant what they want to do. They're very much stomach people. They're very, very vain, both of them, if not a little narcissistic at times. They're not avid readers of files. They very much rely on being briefed by people. And then based on those briefings, they would make a decision. Putin, for one, is a person that, you know, people always say the guy has a long-term plan. He does not. He decides a problem the day the problem appears. Mm-hmm. And tomorrow is another day. And the reason he's doing it, and people also don't understand that, he is actually fighting to stay president every single day. There's new challenges he's dealing with.
Do you think, Franz, that Vladimir Putin was involved in sourcing Christopher Steele in the infamous Trump dossier?
When you look at this so-called dossier, it's a miracle that someone with the qualifications of a Mr. Steele would even bring that to paper, let alone publish that. And the Russians have done a brilliant job on supplying disinformation to Mr. Steele. And for me, it's just unbelievable that anyone would lend any credibility to that stuff. But they have done, from a Russian perspective, they had a mission and they accomplished it successfully.
You've been in his presence. He's a small man physically, Mr. Putin is, but is he a dangerous fellow?
He can be a dangerous fellow when he, just like Mr. Trump, he never forgets when he gets insulted, and he will go after these people. His his list is long.
Well, the
and
book
his memory is even longer.
His memory is even longer. The book is Welcome to Putingrad. It's an interesting book from somebody who knows Vladimir Putin and won a court battle with him, Franz Settlemyer. Franz, I know you have a website. What's the best way, if our listeners want to find out more, short of buying your book, what's the best way to find out more about what you're doing?
The first thing you should do is you go on Amazon and just put in one word, Putingrad, and our book will come up. And then you should also definitely visit our website. It's www.welcometoputingrad.com, and you can actually read the first chapter for free. You can download that, and you can also listen to the first chapter of the audiobook.
All right, we do have to roll, but thank you, Franz Settlemyer. The book is Welcome to Putingrad. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening. Have a great day, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.